From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we examine violence in American culture. My first guest is author David Schmidt. His book, Natural Born Celebrities, looks at why serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, and John Wayne Gacy have become iconic figures in America. He'll tell us about the historical roots of this preoccupation with serial killers in popular culture and how it has grown throughout the years. Then we'll talk with Iowa State University psychology professor Craig Anderson about new research on the effects of violent video games. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we explore our fascination with violence, our preoccupation with the serial killer, and how violence is ingrained in American popular culture. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Iowa State University psychology professor Craig Anderson. He's just finished leading a new study that he says proves conclusively that exposure to violent video games makes more aggressive, less caring kids. But first, a conversation with David Schmidt, associate professor of English at the University of Buffalo. Schmidt is the author of the book Natural Born Celebrities, Serial Killers in American Culture. Schmidt argues the existence of famous serial killers in contemporary American culture brings together two defining features of American modernity, stardom and violence. David Schmidt will give a public lecture tonight at 7 p.m. at Grinnell College's Peace Studies Conference entitled The Banality of American Violence. I spoke with David Schmidt yesterday and began asking him why he chose America's fascination with violence as a focus for his research.
A couple of reasons. Probably the first reason is that I'm a naturalized American citizen, but I'm originally from England. And when I came to the U.S. to go to graduate school, one of the things that struck me immediately was the interest Americans had in violence and popular culture, which you can find in England, of course, but it seemed to me much more developed over here. And not soon after I arrived, Silence of the Lambs, the movie version, was released. And then the Jeffrey Dahmer case broke soon after that. And then there was another very high-profile case in Florida at around the same time. And it just seemed to me that as a student of culture, something was going on here that needed to be investigated in more detail. So I guess it gave me a little bit of an opportunity to understand my own adopted country a little better.
So why do we find such repulsive individuals so fascinating?
I think a large part of the attraction comes from the fact that they seem so very much like us. And my favorite example of this is many of your listeners may recall the Son of Sam case in New York City in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And before an arrest in that case was made, this person, this individual, had achieved the status of some kind of legend. They seemed almost a supernatural kind of being. And when an arrest was made, David Berkowitz, who was a postal worker in Yonkers, was arrested and convicted of those crimes. I think a lot of people had the reaction when they saw him, this is it. This is the Son of Sam. And you couldn't find someone who looked more ordinary and more unthreatening. And so I think it's that combination that fascinates people.
When we look at popular television programs right now, your description of Son of Sam also fits the popular character in the Showtime series Dexter, the serial killer who kills other serial killers.
Very much so. And I think Dexter's a particularly interesting example in terms of serial killer pop culture because, from my point of view, a big part of the success of that series is that it has solved a problem that a lot of serial killer pop culture has to face. And that problem is, how do you get your audience to identify with a character that does such terrible things? Mm-hmm. And to go back to Silence of the Lambs, for example, that film solved the problem by giving us two serial killers. We had Hannibal Lecter on the one hand and Buffalo Bill on the other. Buffalo Bill was, in essence, the bad serial killer. And that left us free to identify with Hannibal, who, by contrast, seemed a much more sympathetic character. And in Dexter, you've got a brilliant solution to that same problem. He kills only people who deserve to be killed. And therefore, we can identify with this character, even though he does horrific things.
You mentioned at the outset, it struck you in coming to the United States that our fascination for serial killers is more developed.
I should be really clear here. I don't think there's anything that happens in this country that you can't find in other countries. But I think, first of all, the sheer amount of pop culture related to violence in this country is so much bigger than in any other country that it's almost not just a difference in degree, it almost becomes a difference in kind. So that's the first thing. The second thing, I think that as Americans, we have a particular relationship with violence and its relation to what it means to be American that you don't really find in any other country. And by that I mean going right back to, you know, the original Indian Wars with the Puritans, or whether it be the settlement of the Western United States, whether it be slavery or the Civil War. All of these things are seen as formative experiences in developing the American character, and all of them are connected to episodes of violence in one way or another. And I think you can see just how widespread our fascination with violence is today. One of the things I encourage people who come to my talks to do is to get hold of their TV guide and get a highlighter pen and go through any page on any night and highlight all of the shows that have to do with violence and crime in some way. And I tell people they'll need soon to buy a new pen because they'll run out of ink. It's everywhere, and yet because of that, it's more difficult for us to see. It's like right in front of us. But we don't notice it because we're just so used to seeing it.
So to use another sort of exercise that is often used in the classroom is if an alien beamed down to our planet and specifically to soak up some popular culture in the United States, he or she might or it might say, what is the deal? What is the fascination here? It would strike that alien in the face in a way that we in the midst of these trees don't see.
Well, I think that's a very good exercise, and I also think that what it would highlight is the huge gap that exists between what we see on television, for example, and reality. I mean, it's worth remembering that from a statistical point of view, a crime like serial murder is, you know, for want of a better word, insignificant, in as much as it accounts for less than 1% of our annual homicide rate in any given year. And yet in terms of its appearance in the media, it saturates our media.
When we look at that, even though it is a relatively minuscule part of crime, serial killers, do we separate that, the fact, from the fiction? Or do we tend to think that our environment, our real environment, when we step away from the television set, is as dangerous as portrayed?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's a tough one to answer. I think on the one hand, we're aware of the fact that the conventions of television crime drama, for example, are going to dictate what kinds of crimes get portrayed. And we're going to be aware on one level that reality may not match that. But in terms of how it affects our everyday lives, I think that it's more difficult to sort of put those ideas to one side. One piece of information that's relevant here, even though rates of violent crime nationally have been going down for some time, the public sphere of crime has proved remarkably resistant to change. And so the perception of how dangerous our society is can often lag behind the reality of how dangerous it is. And I think the media is part of the reason for that.
Through programs like the very popular CSI series.
And CSI is an interesting example, partly because it panders to that fear. And so, you know, it presents a world in which violent crime is an everyday part of reality and it's constantly happening. But the reason for the popularity of CSI is not just that it frightens us. If it did that, it wouldn't have lasted for as long as it has. What it also does, it gives us a framework within which these crimes can be understood and they can be solved, and we can feel that something is being done about it. And this is why a character like Gil Grissom becomes such a hero to so many people, because we may feel that violent crime is out of control, but within the space of a 60-minute show every single night, we can see crime explained and brought under control and something being done about it.
What about the discussion of this fascination for serial killers or for killers, murderers, when we step away from Hollywood, from TV and film? And I'm thinking specifically of us, the news media. Iowans have a specific example this week, a story making national headlines. A man was convicted of killing a prominent nationally recognized high school football coach. And I'm not sure if you heard about that. The killer walked into a high school weight room, shot and killed the coach in front of players who were at the facility. So how does a case like that fit into the points you make in the book?
I think it's related in the sense that one case can come to stand in for a lot of other things. And so in a sense, it takes on a weight that goes beyond the individual circumstances of the crime. So you see these high-profile cases. Part of the reason certain cases become high-profile is that they seem to sort of tap in to larger anxieties or larger concerns in our society. And so I think that very often when we see these crimes which are seemingly inexplicable, which seemingly come out of nowhere, we look for ways to explain them. We look for ways to understand them, and partly because out of natural human curiosity, but also because we just want to feel that there is a reason that this happened. And so school shootings, for example, part of the reason they get such widespread media coverage is because they always sort of tap into an enduring concern that we've lost touch with our young people and that the future of our society is somehow at stake in cases like this. And this is why school-related incidents tend to get very, very high coverage.
Unfortunately, the University of Iowa was the site of one of those early campus shootings nearly 20 years ago, the Gang Lu shooting, a former graduate student. The shooter killed four faculty members and one student. So that has been replicated many times since the Gang Lu shooting. And you're saying it could be in part due to the popularization in culture?
That is a very difficult question to answer. And my personal feeling is that I've spent the better part of 20 years now studying violence and the role that it plays in American culture. And if I've come to any one conclusion, it is that there is no single explanation that is going to apply to all cases. And I say that because in this field, people are very, very fond of saying this is the cause. And if we can do something about this, whether it be controlling television or video games or whatever it happens to be, that we can make a serious difference. I wouldn't reject those arguments out of hand. I certainly think it's something we need to be concerned about. But I really have to disagree with this idea that there's a strong cause-effect relationship. Violence is a classic example of something that has many, many reasons for why it happens. There are many different explanations, all of which have to be considered simultaneously.
Coming up in just a moment, more of my conversation with David Schmid, the author of Natural Born Celebrities, Serial Killers in American Culture. Schmid speaks tonight at the Grinnell College Peace Studies Conference. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's get back to my conversation with David Schmid, Associate Professor of English at Buffalo State University. Schmid will discuss violence in American culture in a lecture tonight at Grinnell College. David, your book, Natural Born Celebrities, examines the popular culture preoccupation with the serial killer. You point out, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, that this preoccupation has historical roots that go way back. What are the earliest cases you see where it's gathering undue attention or taking hold in popular culture in America?
Well, I think the earliest example I can think of would actually surprise many people because it goes back to the Puritan era. And this is a time in our country's history that we normally would not associate with violence, and we certainly wouldn't associate it with a public fascination for violence. But the fact of the matter is that some of the largest public gatherings in Puritan-era America were for executions. And the whole community would come together to witness this execution, and the ministers would take this opportunity to preach to the crowds so that they could be sure that the members of the crowd were getting the proper message about what they were seeing. Later, these sermons were printed and sold and distributed very widely among members of the community, and I see this as the first one of the first examples of popular culture in this country that's organized around violence. They were incredibly popular and very, very widely read. So even as early as that time, there is this fascination with people who step outside the rules of the community and a kind of interest about what should we do about them, how should we think about them, what should our reaction be to them.
How does that explain, though, the departure that you see when you came to the United States from your native Britain to see the popularization of serial killers in American culture? What caused that departure?
I think the simple answer is that people realized it sold, and that there was no easier way to make money than to go down to the lowest common denominator and give people explicit details about crimes. And you can see this in a variety of genres, and each new medium that's come into being, it's always had its issues about how far can it push the envelope of representing violence. So if you look in terms of the newspaper media during the 19th century, the big revolution that happened in newspapers in the early decades of the 19th century was the so-called penny press or yellow press. And that made its name by publishing sensational crime stories. If you look at the medium of film, you get the same issues there. Television, the same issues again. But I think the other thing that's going on here, and this is why I have the word celebrities in the title to my book, what we're also seeing here is a very gradual change in what it means to be famous and how you become famous. In the old days, it used to be that you had to be good at something in order to be famous. You needed to have some kind of merit, some kind of achievement. And over time, that idea gradually changed, where fame could be acquired not necessarily by achievement, but simply by getting people's attention, by visibility. And once that standard had changed, crime became almost a guaranteed way to achieve a certain kind of fame or notoriety. So I think it's those two things together.
Your book also makes an interesting connection, the curious intersection of serial murder in a post-9/11 world. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, this actually sort of relates to the fact that I was finishing up this book when the events of 9/11 took place, and my expectation at the time was that we would see a very sharp distinction between pre-9/11 America and post-9/11 America with regards to the place of serial killers. And my initial assumption would be that essentially the figure of the terrorist would replace the figure of the serial killer. In fact, that did not happen. The serial killer continues, in a sense, to be alive and well in a post-9/11 America, and we mentioned earlier the success of a series like Dexter. That's a perfect example of that. But more particularly, I think the role of serial murder changed in our culture after 9/11, because compared to the terrorist, who seemed a genuinely unknown, shadowy, frightening figure, as bizarre as it sounds, the serial killer actually, by that time, was quite a familiar quantity to us. We knew the figure. We knew what to expect. We'd seen many films and television programs. We'd read many true crime books about these people. And so we felt much more familiar with them than we did with the terrorists. And so in a bizarre kind of way, it was after 9/11 that the serial killer really became an accepted part of American culture.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because isn't the serial killer, in many cases, harder to identify when we think of the Boston Strangler and Tony Curtis's portrayal? We're fascinated and terrified by the fact that it could be anyone. It could be a nice guy, seemingly nice guy like Dexter, or
yep.
Someone played by Tony Curtis.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, to go back to your earlier question, this is part of the fascination. And I think another enduring reason for people's interest in this figure is that, let's take a case, for example, like the Dennis Rader, who was arrested in Wichita, Kansas a few years ago, the BTK killer. There you have someone who's a classic example of an individual who appeared to be a pillar of his community before his arrest. And people who knew him, and in some cases they'd known him for many years, were genuinely sort of shocked by the fact that he could have done these things. And I think that's a very emblematic case, because what it illustrates is that we may know in a sort of subconscious way that we may have lived on a street for many years, but how well do we really know our neighbors? how well do we know the people down the street? We feel in some ways that we live in a community of strangers. And so the serial killer, in a sense, kind of highlights that fact. We can be living right next to someone, yet how much do we really know about how they spend their time and what they do? And the serial killer reminds us of that fact.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, Iowa's connection with the serial killer, John Wayne Gacy, spending the 1960s married and in Waterloo, Iowa, making money as Pogo the Clown.
Absolutely.
That is truly terrifying.
Yeah, it's a notorious example. And Gacy, of course, is very interesting from another point of view because he is the apex of what is sometimes known as the murderabilia industry. This is a collection of websites on which you can buy artwork done by incarcerated serial killers and murderers, but you can also buy letters and postcards that they've written, and in some cases you can even buy things like hair samples. And Gacy's oil paintings, either of Disney characters or of clowns, are some of the hottest selling items in this industry.
What is it, if there is a solution or a way to improve this, I don't know if you want to even suggest that in your book, or have suggested it, the key to changing the mindset of our culture in the way it views violence?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm sure you probably won't be surprised to learn that I'm a little bit skeptical about solutions. I think this has been around for too long and is too deeply rooted in our nature to think that it's ever going to go away. But I do think that what we can do is to become more self-conscious about what it is that we're doing and what it is that we're consuming. So if people take a little time to sort of think, for example, exactly why they tune into CSI every week, or why they're sort of wait for their next true crime book to come out, or why they're so obsessed with Dexter, I think that would be a good start. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to stop watching these things or stop reading these books, but at least if we can sort of take a little moment to think about exactly what is the nature of the pleasure that we derive from them.
David Schmidt, in the next segment of our program, we'll be talking to a researcher at Iowa State University, a psychology professor, about a new study that proving conclusively, he says, that violent video game play makes kids more aggressive. Now, I'm wondering about the connection between your work and his. For instance, do you think that being a first-person shooter in a video game, acting it out in a virtual world, is qualitatively different than merely watching a killer on a TV show or in a movie?
I think, again, there may be a difference in degree, but I wouldn't really say that there is a difference in kind. I think a lot of the popular culture that we watch encourages us to adopt the point of view of violent criminals, and that is something that is easy to see in many different media. I have no doubt that there's an issue with some video games, but I also feel that in some respects, video games are, if you'll forgive the expression, something of an easy target. I think it's easy to sort of scapegoat something like video games or rap music, which tend to be the two things that people go after most, whereas things like, you know, documentaries or news coverage or television drama shows are left relatively untouched. But in terms of the scale of the problem and in terms of the number of people that are reached by these shows, I think CSI is probably just as worthy of investigation as video games.
David Schmidt, thank you very much for this conversation. It's been fascinating.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, Iowa State University psychology professor Craig Anderson. He's just finished leading a study that he says proves conclusively that exposure to violent video games increases aggressive behavior. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News.
Getting you out. Here, put this on. You'll need it.
I'll take those.
Not anymore. Things have changed.
Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you could join us over the noon hour. Craig Anderson has made much of his life's work studying how violent video game play affects youth behavior. Anderson, an Iowa State University Distinguished Professor of Psychology, has just finished leading a new study that analyzed 130 research reports on more than 130,000 subjects worldwide. He says it proves conclusively that exposure to violent video games makes more aggressive, less caring kids. And this is regardless of their age, sex, or culture. The study is published in the March 2010 issue of the Psychological Bulletin, an American Psychological Association journal.
Anderson is also director of Iowa State's Center for the Study of Violence. Craig Anderson joins us this afternoon from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Professor Anderson.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Great to be with you again. In what way does this new study erase any doubt that violent video games make more aggressive, less caring kids?
It's a good question. Up until very recently, only two of the major, three major types of research methods had been used in this particular domain. We had experimental studies, kind of studies where, say, kids are brought into a lab, randomly assigned to play a violent game or a nonviolent game, and then some kind of measure, aggressive behavior or aggressive thinking, right, would be taken afterwards. There have been a number of those out for a number of years. There have also been quite a few studies that we would call cross-sectional correlation studies. These are, you might think of these as your typical kind of questionnaire or survey study where you get measures of their typical gaming habits and other sorts of things, and then also get measures of aggressive behavior or aggressive thinking and simply run a correlation. And both of those have shown for years a strong link between exposure to violent video games and aggressive behavior and several other outcomes. The real novel part of this review is that just in the last few years, the third type of study, longitudinal studies, there have been a number of those published. Actually, the first one published in English was done by my colleagues Doug Gentile and Catherine Buckley and me. We published in a book in 2007. But now there's a number of such studies from Japan and from several different countries in Europe. And a longitudinal study is one in which you measure the same kids, let's say, over a 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 month period. There's one or two studies now have followed the same ones for a couple of years. And what you do, for example, in one of our studies, we assessed a number of elementary school children at the beginning of the school year. We got measures of aggression from their teachers, from their classmates, as well as from self-reports. And measures, again, a number of control variables at the beginning of the school year. And then we went back roughly 6 months later, got those same measures, and then we were able to look to see if their video game habits, as measured early in the school year, predict increases or decreases of aggressive behavior over the course of the school year. And what we found that study and now in this new meta-analysis, what many other people have found now, is that, in fact, you get these long-term effects even after you control for how aggressive the kids were, let's say, early in the school year.
I think you addressed that there in the final part. So I'm thinking, so wouldn't naturally more aggressive kids gravitate towards aggressive, violent video games anyway?
Well, there's a tendency for that to happen, but in a longitudinal study, if it's done well, and again, there's now about a dozen or so such data sets out there, you can test which direction the causal arrow goes. You can test, is it the case that violent video games are producing more aggressive behavior, or is it the case that aggressive kids gravitate towards violent video games? And it's also, of course, possible that both of those are true. Mm-hmm. That is, both causal paths occur. And while I believe that both causal paths occur, in fact, what the evidence currently shows is very strong evidence that the violent games cause an increase in the likelihood of later aggressive behavior. There's not much evidence that aggressive kids as being aggressive early sort of predicts an increase in playing violent video games later on.
Mm-hmm. And this study goes for, these conclusions go for both the short-term and the long-term context. So what are you measuring there?
Well, the short-term kind of effects, again, have kind of been known for several years in the field, and those typically come from experimental studies, which are really the strongest way of establishing causality. So we know that playing a video game for as little as 15 minutes, playing a violent video game for as little as 15 minutes or so, increases the likelihood of aggressive behavior in that situation. It also increases the likelihood or increases the amount of aggressive thinking, the amount of aggressive affect or what you might think of as anger. It increases desensitization or what you might think of as low empathy. And it decreases helping behavior.
Pro-social behavior, because I know at ISU
right.
there's also been a look at how pro-social games encourage actual pro-social behavior when you're not in front of the screen.
That's exactly right. Doug Gentile and myself and some people in Singapore. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people actually on that research project. But yeah, we published a paper a couple of years ago. Well, I guess it was last year, maybe.
Yeah, Doug was on our show to talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fairly recently. Now, this is also in regards to regardless of the age, the sex of the child, youngster, or the culture, right? Because
right.
this was from around the world.
Right. In that study, we had people. One of the studies focused on participants from Singapore, and the other studies were from the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, that one of the things about this new meta-analysis that we just published on violent game effects is we also had a large number of studies from Japan, studies that previously were not accessible to most of the rest of the research world because they had originally been published in Japanese. But as a result of a trip I had made to Japan a few years ago, I was able to make some contacts with the leading media researchers in Japan, and so they played a real central role in this new meta-analysis.
Mm-hmm. So even though you found this causation across age, sex, and culture, is there a demographic where it is more pronounced, say a Japanese boy being most affected by violent video games?
That's a good question, and we've looked at you know, for groups that are, let's say, particularly susceptible or groups that are immune, as have other researchers around the world. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any particular group that's immune. You know, it's not the case that, you know, girls, for example, are immune, or that people in a low-violence culture like
Japan.
But
we do know that girls play fewer of the violent video games, don't we?
Right. We know that they play considerably fewer hours of violent games, but when they do play violent games, they're affected the same way that boys are.
Okay.
So...
Okay, let me come at this from a perspective as a parent, as many of our listeners are coming at it, you as well.
Oh,
I'm
yes.
Sure, so what is the degree to which violent video games affect our kids? I mean, are we, to take an extreme, perhaps absurd example, we have a beaver cleaver at home. He's not going to be turned into a Ted Bundy by one of these video games.
No, and that's a very good point. You know, a lot of the critics who, you know, a lot of the gaming sites and whatnot, you know, they set up this sort of straw man, you know, and there's, oh, we got all these people playing violent games and they're not all school shooters. And you say, well, you know, none of us have ever said that that's what the outcome would be. Basically, for extremely violent behavior, school shootings or, you know, murders, homicides or career criminals, whatnot, those kinds of extreme events occur only when there is a pretty large set of risk factors present in the same individual. And we know there's, you know, a dozen or so known causal risk factors for developing into a more aggressive and violent person. Media violence is one of those risk factors. And it turns out it's not the biggest in terms of its effect. So, for example, things like joining an inner city gang.
That's going to be a better predictor.
That's a big risk factor.
Right.
Considering that many of them, you know, you have to commit a violent crime to become a full member.
Right.
Yeah, that's a pretty big risk factor.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out that high exposure to media violence is as big a risk factor as most of the others. It's roughly in the same ballpark as things like being physically abused as a child, or growing up in a violent neighborhood, or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing to me about the media violence risk factor compared to the others is that media violence is something that a parent can do without any, they can do something about without any intervention, without any increase in funds from anybody. Whereas a lot of the risk factors are things that a parent can't control. So we know that there are some genetic kinds of things that play a role.
I don't know. I, as a father of teenagers, I find it pretty hard to control the video games, but I know what you mean.
Right. Yeah. That's easier than controlling your genetics, okay?
I've got you.
if you're living in a violent neighborhood. Well, people who live in violent neighborhoods typically aren't there by choice, right? If they could afford to move somewhere else, they would. But a parent who understands that, in fact, media violence is a risk factor, they can take some action, right? They can actually take control or at least some control over their child's media diet. And they can also talk to them about why certain kinds of video games, for example, are harmful and how those games inadvertently promote values that are not their family's values. These are things that don't really cost any money,
mm-hmm.
but you're right. They cost time and effort and at least the occasional slammed door, I would guess.
Craig Anderson is my guest for the rest of the hour. If you just joined us, Craig Anderson is an Iowa State University Distinguished Professor of Psychology, Director of ISU's Center for the Study of Violence, a new study that he led, analyzed a number of things worldwide, and says the study proves conclusively that exposure to violent video games makes more aggressive, less caring kids, regardless of age, sex, or culture. If you'd like to join our conversation, quickly get in on the conversation before the end of the hour, 1-866-780-9100. What are your concerns about violent video games? Perhaps you are a gamer and you want to dispute some of this or have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Professor Anderson, did you examine specific popular violent video games such as Halo, Gears of War come to mind?
Well, some of the experimental studies, use obviously very specific games, but the kind of games that get used or the specific titles vary so much across studies that it isn't the case that there's 30 studies on Grand Theft Auto or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few such studies starting to come out individually, and there is some evidence that, for example, Grand Theft Auto and similar games in which you play the role of a criminal, right? In which you're in this criminal underworld and the whole thing is antisocial. There's some evidence, although it's very tentative at this point, that such games may produce larger kind of antisocial effects than, say, violent games where you're rescuing the princess or where you're the, mm-hmm. the good guy saving the world from the alien monsters or whatever are coming down. But that's very preliminary. There aren't enough studies of that kind yet to sort of make the call that, yep, this definitely is true. I won't go that far yet.
I want to go to a couple calls if we can, but briefly, I wonder if you think this study, because it's so conclusive, but also as we presumably get more studies that back up this study, how do you think this will affect the use of video games? Any real consequences here, or is this just ivory tower studies that will be ignored and the video game industry won't react, the consumers won't react? It's something we know, but for instance, will we ever see on a video game, in the same way we see warnings on cigarettes, playing this video game may result in more aggressive, less caring behavior?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Historically, of course, the media industries have been very successful in both keeping the general public ignorant about what the research actually shows. So, for example, we've known for 20 years that violent television shows and violent movies produces essentially the same kind of effects that I've been talking about in terms of violent video games. I mean, that's been known for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And what we end up getting is rating systems that are designed by the industry instead of by scientists, and rating systems that are controlled by the industry, and that in the sort of end of the day kind of thing, are not, enforceable, and many times are not enforced. So what I'm kind of hoping in the long run is that we'll see a little bit more public debate about how to deal with this risk factor, and when in this case, not just video games, but all forms of media violence. If we can do a better job of educating the general public, if we can do a better job of educating parents, I mean, it's certainly true that already there are a number of parents that are taking more steps to monitor and actively control what their kids are seeing or playing. And in fact, there are lots of very good video games out there that are not violent. In fact, both of my kids grew up playing video games. So I've been a gamer since 1978, which of course means I was actually playing text-based games on a mainframe computer back when we had punch cards.
So, that's a real nerdy thing to do, if you don't mind.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's go try to squeeze in a couple of calls, please, Professor Anderson. Aaron is joining us from Iowa City. Quickly, Aaron, we don't have much time. What is on your mind?
Sure. I was wondering if the guest had heard of the book Fighting or Killing Monsters by Gerard Jones, where he argues that children actually need to play some sort or to take part in some violent media,
right,
because it does establish coping mechanisms that they need in life.
And sort of coping or cathartic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get a reaction to that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with the book. Gerard Jones is not a scientist. He's a writer, or journalist. He's not really trained as a scientist. And in fact, what he's espousing is what is known as the catharsis theory of aggression. And he's wrong. I mean, there's reams and reams of data going back many, many years, going back over 40 years now, showing that his basic thesis is simply incorrect. It's a very well-written, very interesting, and scholarly work. And at one level, I mean, I wish he was right. But, he's just wrong.
Let's go to Joel in Des Moines. Joel, hi. Welcome to our program.
Hi. I had a question as far as the age ranges of what you had used in the studies. As far as, would you say that you're going to view similar effects more in the adult range? I know a lot of the more mature and violent video games are aimed at people, ages 18 and older.
Right.
Nice question, Joel.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good question. What we've most of these studies, the age range is typically from, say, elementary school age, 6, 7, 8 years old, up through college age. So, there are a lot of studies done with college students. There really aren't any studies that focus on, say, 30-year-olds or 40-year-olds. So it's hard to say what the effect is likely to be there. But within that age range of say 6-year-olds to 22-year-olds or so, there's very little evidence that the younger kids are more affected than the older. Although there's good theoretical reasons to think that once you get to be say in the early 20s or so, that long-term effects are probably going to be smaller. Short-term effects are likely to be about the same size.
Nick is in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Nick. Finishing up our hour here. Quickly, what do you have to share with us?
I just wanted to just confirm. I did a lot of first-person shooter gaming all through college and as a young father. And just since I quit and kind of got on the wagon, haven't played for a long time, I've noticed I've been very much less aggressive at home. And my wife's also much more pleased with my behavior. So I just wanted to confirm that.
Mm-hmm.
Games are addictive. they can be quit, and they do increase aggressiveness. I mean, I never was mean. I just find myself much more patient.
Nick, did you find that did you quit because you thought you should quit, or because the desire just sort of faded as you aged?
Nope, the desire never faded, and right. I have a lot of friends that play, and I still, you know, I still feel a little tempted every once in a while. I quit mostly for my family.
Uh-huh. So what kind of restrictions do you have now as a father for kids?
Well, you know, I have a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old, and we stick with, I find if you stick with the Nintendo Wii and you keep games at E-rated, they're a lot of fun and they're not violent.
Mm-hmm. But then there are the neighbor kids who might have the M-rated video games, right?
That's right, and my kids will get in trouble if they partake in that.
All right, very good. Nick, thank you for that firsthand experience from a former first-person shooter, I guess, self-described. Nick, thank you from Cedar Rapids in the virtual world, of course. Let's end up here with that question that Nick left us with, Professor Anderson. What should you do? What kind of action do you think, if not on a legislative level, you don't think the industry is going to do anything but rate these, what do parents need to most keep in mind when these violent video games are around in stores?
All right. What parents need to do is they before they buy a game or allow a child of theirs to have a particular game is they need to see the game played or at least go to the web and see some samples of what the game is about. And the reason for that is because even a large number of the E-rated games have as their basic theme killing the bad guys. And we've shown in one experimental study that even college students playing children's games, if those children's games have as their main theme killing the bad guys,
right.
Even when they're happy music and cute characters and no blood and gore, we've shown that increases aggressive behavior even of college students. So you need to know what the content is.
Just a few seconds left. Yeah,
and if the content is you got to kill or hurt or harm other characters to advance in the game,
pick another game
because there are a lot of really really good ones out there.
Thank you very much, Craig Anderson, ISU Distinguished Professor of Psychology, Director of the Center for the Study of Violence at ISU, talking about this new study. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Anderson.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Our producer assistant today, Christoph Mai. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.